Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 7th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Death Penalty and Policy Questions Plus What Can We Do? Presented by Ingrid Christensen. The number is CH-I-2006-07. Let's listen in.
For those of you who are not aware, I work in Chicago, and my work is to prepare the sentencing portion of trials where the state is asking for the death penalty or the federal government. And I do it in many different states, and most are in Illinois because that's where I live in, because we have a lot of death cases there. But I travel too. And the way I do that is by studying the person's life, listening to the story of that person's life, both from the accused's voice, which means I spend lots and lots and lots of hours in prisons and jails, and from their loved ones and families and their enemies and their teachers and their pastors and their neighbors and whoever I can get to tell me the family secrets. And usually it takes a couple of years to assemble this, and I get all of their records. So I get their school records, their medical records, their mother's medical records, probably their brothers and sisters' medical records if they'll sign releases, and their incarceration records, their military records, any kind of records they've generated. If you think about your own life, you know, if I got you, and I could.
Leave a paper trail, and you will follow it.
Leave a paper trail, and I will follow it, and it will help you. You'll be glad you did. You know, there are a lot of falsely accused people, so it could be you, even if you didn't do it. Most of my clients are guilty. I'm private, so people call me up and say, do you have time for another case? You know, a lawyer will say, I've got a new death case. Do you have time to take it? I will listen to the facts of the case and decide if it's a case that I can fit into my life. I would say that I turn a case down every 2 weeks. So there's an awful need for this work. Even though I am paid by the state and I am not in any kind of a religious work, I have privacy in prisons and jails and in families' living rooms and kitchens, mostly around the kitchen table. So I do a lot of praying and a lot of singing of hymns and a lot of Bible stories, because it helps actually move us ahead in our work. I would say of the 25 clients I've had, I'm not sure that every single one hasn't wanted at some point in the development of the defense, hasn't wanted to die. And I've had one commit suicide. So, a number have tried to commit suicide. I get a hold of them. But I spend a lot of time fighting suicide as part of my work. We study the Bible, and if they're Muslims, we study the Quran and the Old Testament. And they increasingly, just so you know, are Muslims. And I think the reason for that is that in prisons, the best ministry that goes on is done by the imams. And the worst ministry that goes on is done by the Lutheran pastors.
Whoa.
I mean, not the Lutheran pastors. There aren't Lutheran pastors there. Lutheran pastors don't do that work. Yeah, it's storefront people, and it's a lot of hellfire and brimstone, blaming pastors who go into. So we'll get to that when we come to what should we be doing. You can see that it's going to be a secret what we should be doing. I wouldn't want to give away my stuff. So we'll talk about that later. Right now, yes?
You said this is prepared for the sentencing phase, because a lot of it doesn't come out in a trial.
Now and then I learn things that do come out in trial. I work very closely with the attorneys in every case. team. We've developed
the
a team process thanks to me. I always say when I'm asked to take a case, I don't work unless it's on a team. You know, we have to have regular team meetings. We have to share these kinds of information. When I get home this Sunday, on Tuesday and Wednesday this week, I'm doing a training for 150 people, all the death penalty lawyers in Cook County and all the mitigation specialists. So, and it's on teams, how to build a team. So, I do learn information that helps with the actual guilt and innocence phase of a trial, but my job is to develop the story that will be presented at the penalty phase, and the penalty phase sometimes, of course, might not happen. Now and then, somebody could be found innocent, in which case my 2 years of work would be for nothing. Of course, yeah, that would be a great triumph. And I tell the accused that, I tell the family members that over and over again, and still it makes them very nervous that I come see them a lot and talk to them a lot. And they say, why aren't you working on the case? Why aren't you out investigating the case? Why are you talking about the fact that he was born a blue baby, floppy and dead? Why are you talking about the toxic waste dump that we lived in for 10 years? Why are you talking about the abuse? You know, why aren't you talking about the case? That's the case. And I say over and over again, I don't do the facts of the case. That's the lawyer's job. That's the investigator's job. There are other people who do that part of the case. I do the sentencing. And the sentencing becomes a play. And you'll be happy to hear that I was an English major in college. So I direct the play, which is the sentencing, and I figure out what the themes are that we're going to present in any given case, and then how those themes are going to be presented on the stage of the courtroom, what voices we're going to call to tell different parts of the story. And if there's a particularly gifted voice, I had a case in I can never remember the difference between Arkansas and Alabama. Alabama. And it was a case where a white family, the kid was accused of killing, attacking, and burning to death a limping, disabled, sort of a fool that hitchhiked around the county, but everybody knew and was fond of, kind of the fool who played the fool in the community. And the dad was abusive to his own family in the extreme. And finally, and the kid was the father of three children and had been married when this happened. His wife divorced him. I say kid. He was, 26 or something, but he seemed like a kid to me. I mean, I'm always a kid. But the father didn't want him to be saved. The father said, the father, of course, was beat up the mother regularly and beat up his children, so everybody was under his thumb, and they were really, you'd go into their trailer, and the electricity in there, the energy in there, he was so controlling, and he was so worried about me, because he didn't think he could control me, you know, and there's a reason for that. I would ask direct questions and confront him on things. So, first they sent me out eventually, I found out that the wife's family lived in a different county in a set of trailers behind a church on a dirt road up a mountain, here and there. So they had to draw me maps and arrange this whole thing, and they were very suspicious of my going there, and the father in particular, because he was this controlling man, and it was his wife's family, and he was worried that they might say things that he didn't approve of, which of course they did. So I arrived there, I drove up this mountain and down this regular road and then out onto a dirt road, and then there was a church on the corner and I turned, and then down behind the church there were these trailers, and on the front of a trailer was a great big, a little bit bigger than the size of this fireplace, square front porch, which was clearly where all their social time was held. And they were waiting for me. 13 of them lined up around this porch. And I walked up to them. Evening. And I just stood there for a while, and they said evening. And then finally, somebody moved over and indicated that this is where I was supposed to sit. And so I sat, and they said, I waited for them to set the agenda. There were 13 of them and one of me. You know, I needed information from these people, but I wasn't going to tell them what to say. And they knew that their kid that they loved was facing the death penalty, and they knew that in their state that was bad because he was probably going to get it. So they said, we got them their boys. And there were two about 10-year-old boys sitting on the railing behind the rest of the family. And they had been pillar to posted through this family, and they had recently been kicked out of their mother, who was in a different county, back to their father, who was sitting here in the circle, who was the family most extreme drunk. And they said, we want you to figure out what we should do with these boys. So, you know, their agenda was, the lady from the city has come. We got to work through these boys. You know, that's what we need you for. So we spent the next couple of hours. I asked everybody in the circle what they thought they could give to these boys, and then I asked the boys what they thought they could give to the circle. We worked it out that the boys could. I said, how come you keep getting in trouble, these two boys? And they told us why they kept getting in trouble, and then different people contributed the trouble. And I said, do you think you boys could stop? And they said, no. I didn't think so. But, you know, this is all in the service of this kid who's facing the death penalty.
Was this a white family or a black family?
White.
I thought it was white, yeah.
And the unnerving thing, I found myself getting kind of, I was really, really concentrating. I work very hard when I'm doing this. I'm so focused on these people and reading the body language. And I found this sort of sense of unease rising in me, which often means I should get out of there. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it just meant my weakness, which is that I hate spitting, and every single one of these people was chewing and spitting. And they were just spitting all over the place, and I thought they were going to spit on my feet, and I thought if I stood up and walked across the porch, I would slip and fall.
Oh, gross.
I mean, it was very gross. So once I realized what it was, I sort of exercised that from my mind and went on, and then finally I got everybody in the circle, including the two boys, to make a promise to be family to each other, because they were going to kick the boys back into the public welfare system, which the boys were just dreading. And so I said, you know, no one of you has got enough to raise these boys. No one of you. You are all limited. Their father is a drunk. You're sitting here drunk now. And he sort of grinned and said, yeah, I sure am. You know,
agreeable, really.
Yeah. And they were of two body types. I mean, I hate to stereotype, but they were either so skinny that they were knock-kneed and they looked like their bones were sort of bent, or they were 400 pounds. You know, there were these two kinds of people sitting around this table, this porch. But, and the whole time I'm thinking, how am I going to bring this scene into the courtroom? Because people need to know, because they loved these two boys. And the love for those two boys was going to be part of my story when I was directing the play in the courtroom. This is a loving family. They're just not any one of them good enough to pull it off. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what happened ultimately to that family, but they all promised, and we specifically talked about what each of them can contribute, who could help with homework, who could do this, who could do that, and who, you know, and the father agreed to cut his drinking down to, I think, a case a day of beer, something like that. And the boys agreed to stop going over into that neighborhood where they keep getting in trouble all the time and not go there because they know they're going to get picked up by the cops. So that was a scene, and now my job is to translate that into something that the jury in that case will think, these people will be hurt if we sentence this kid to death, and they can love him from a distance in a way that will make his life in prison worthwhile. Ultimately, on that case, the father, I arranged with the judge to have a private, personal visit of my client with his three children and his ex-wife, where I was the only person present. I had to be there because somebody had to be there. You know, they weren't going to let this happen. And in that little jail where he was, in that county, in whichever state it was, Alabama, you could never touch your family. So he'd been there for 2 years, and he'd never been allowed, and you couldn't bring children in there. The jailer had just arbitrarily decided that no children could come in here. So he hadn't seen his kids except out a window now and then for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So I knew the kid was offered a plea. I knew he had to take the plea or he'd get the death penalty. So I just went to the judge and explained that I had to have this afternoon he had to be in civilian clothes and we could have to be in a private space. So a block away was an attorney's office. We could use the office. The guards all escorted us over there. And he spent the afternoon with his children climbing on his lap, sitting and hugging them. He and his former wife sat across kitty corner across the corner of the table from each other and held hands, and he just apologized to her for screwing up so bad. It was methamphetamines that mm-hmm. had done it. And she apologized, and they both cried and cried, and they talked about the path their life had taken and how sad it was. And they, you know, he said, "I promise to try to be a good father from jail." And she said, "I promise to bring your children to see you always and not mm-hmm. to quit bringing them, no matter who I'm with." And so we made a deal that he was going to take a plea. Mm-hmm. And then he said, "I have to take it today, or I'll change my mind because my dad will get to me." Mm-hmm. So then we opened up the table, invited his parents and his sister in, and he said, before they came in, "Ingrid, I want you on one side of me, and I want the attorney on the other side of me," so that, he hadn't hugged his parents. Anyhow, he said, "I have an announcement to make. I'm taking a plea." But the parents did not, back to the beginning of the switch, they didn't want him to take a plea. The father didn't. Because the father said, "It will bring shame on me in this town. I want to be able to sit down at 10 o'clock in the morning at the cafe on the town square with my friends and say, my boy went down on a crime he didn't do." And I said, "But you know, he did the crime." He said, "I want to be able to say."
Oh my, is that selfish or what?
So he wanted him to be executed.
So that he looked good.
So he'd look good. His first argument, which took us several months to work through, was that the kid had to stand trial for the death penalty because he couldn't be in the general population because he would get beat up because he was racist and the black folks would beat him up. And I said, "Well, that might be. Until he learns to get along with different kinds of people, he might get beat up, but he won't get dead." And then, so the father had to leave that alone. Then he said, "Well, I don't want him to be in the general population because you can get drugs there, and he's a drug addict." And I said, "That's true. He has to make up his own mind. Is he going to go on using drugs or not in the general population? But if he goes on death row, he will get dead." And so, and then finally it came out. It was his business about morning coffee. So that's my job.
Can I ask a question, Rachel? Have any of you, or specifically Ingrid, have you heard of the project of Frontline on PBS that took them about 2.5 years called Country Boys? It is the most marvelous parallel with this. I'm struck by this. It's about this place called Timothy, Kentucky, that was a mining town where the mines were all exhausted and the mining companies pulled everything out. Just left this place.
I've seen it.
And all these people mm-hmm. were still alive. You know, they don't disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And they followed, the mm-hmm. thing that they do is exactly like you do. They followed these two boys in every possible nook and cranny of their life and every relationship and interviewed. And it was the most marvelous human story.
Okay, so let's remember that. Country mm-hmm. Boys. Thank you.
That's great.
So I want to tell you, what are some things about the system that you should be watching for in your own towns, in your own states? Because they're all subject to law and they get changed from time to time. These things come up. And you are members of a community with some responsibility to keep an eye on what happens. innocent people are executed. They're executed, 123 people have been released from death row in the United States since 1975 as being found completely innocent. These are 123 people who were tried, found guilty, given the death penalty, somewhere in their appeals process, and just mostly through a fluke, they're found innocent. I want to read you a quote from a justice in Illinois called Moses Harrison. And he said, "There have been so many mistakes in such a short span of time, the only conclusion I can draw is that the system does not work as the Constitution requires it to." This is an Illinois Supreme Court justice. "If these men dodged the executioner, it was only because of luck and the dedication of the attorneys, reporters, family members, and volunteers who labored to win their release. They survived despite the criminal justice system, not because of it." So all people who say, well, see, they got released, the system works. The truth is that left to the devices of the court system, they would probably have all ended up dead at the hands of the state for crimes they did not commit. One must wonder how many others have not been so fortunate. So we do, there's the truth in one of these truth death penalty organizations said that they found proof that 23 people have been executed who were innocent in the United States in this century, the last century. There was one just before I came up to Holden, there was one found in Texas, so I guess the number is 24 now. But you know that number is underreported. We don't know how many people.
How many people are executed every year in the United States? Do we have that number?
Yeah, I know that. I know that number. Not in my brain, but on paper. I think it's something like 65. Okay. Now, the numbers are down. It used to be more, and it's gotten down.
And are most of them in Texas?
Yes, three quarters of them are in Texas. Many of them are in Houston,
yep,
which is the big state in Texas where they, I mean the big city where they mostly do this.
How many states still have death penalty laws?
38 have them.
Okay.
And so 12 don't.
Okay.
Wisconsin is voting on it this fall.
Okay.
To put it in.
Wow.
Death penalty. Mm. So if any of you are from Wisconsin. One of the problems, one of the many ways that it's broken is that there's an increasing amount of pressure from the prosecutors and judges to speed up the system. And every time it speeds up, there's less chance for doing justice. So my job takes 2 years to get done with, you know, get through a family and get the documents. And it takes a long time to do this work. I do about 5 clients at once of this kind. And then I do a couple of clients of victim outreach, where I spend time with the families of murder victims from the defense point of view and give them information and answer their questions. So speeding up the system denies justice. There's just no other way to look at it. Then there's the issue of race. Race denies justice because the system is so racist. So I'm going to read you another quote. From arrest to sentencing. This is an article written by Stephen Bright, who is my biggest hero in this field. I lionize and hero so many of the defenders who've worked in this field for years. They're a wonderful group of people. It's an honor to work with them. But Stephen Bright is really quite sensational. He is the, he runs something called he's the director of the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta, Georgia. A senior lecturer at Emory Law School, visiting lecturer at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. From arrest to sentencing, the criminal justice system treats people differently based on their race. A person of color is more likely than a white person to be stopped by the police, number one. To be abused by the police during that stop, number two. And once you've been abused, you get adrenaline and you get afraid and you get less competent to take care of yourself. To be arrested, to be denied bail by a judge. to be, then, you know, this is all really solid research, and he cites all the research here, to be charged with a serious crime once you've been arrested. Lots of people are charged with serious crimes, not the one for which they're arrested when they're arrested. To be convicted of that crime and to receive a harsher sentence. So if you're a person of color, going into the system, it's like dragging a huge anchor at every step of the way.
Is that Asian and black, or is it just black?
They just looked at persons of color. So Asian, black, Latino, all kinds of people. For example, in Georgia, a white person is 3 to 6 times more likely to be put on probation than a person of color. Why? One answer is overt racism. That another answer is the unconscious racism of those who make every effort to be fair. Conscientious judges who have had no experience with people of other races may be stereotyping, and you know how all that stuff works. So that is, race is a, black people make up 12% of the population in the United States, and they are accused of 60%, no, they are victims. 60% of the victims of murder are black. And I have an overhead thing here that I'm not going to show, but I can pass them around because I have the hard copies. I'll pass around a bunch of stuff. The race of victims. I think I have the numbers wrong, but black people, trust me, black people are execute, oh, they're 60% of the victims of crimes, but of the people who are executed, or who are given the death penalty, 60% of the victims of those murders are white. So even though many more black people are killed than white people, the death penalty is asked for white people. So white lives lost are considered to be more valuable than black lives lost. So racism is just all the way through it. And we have this notion, which is that we have equal protection under the law. So all of these things I'm mentioning are a violation to our spirit because of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. We have it actually written down that people are entitled to equal protection.
How and the juries you've seen, are they always tried by a group
jury
of
their
peers?
I don't know the answer to that. You know, I'd be surprised, but
yeah, well, I would be too. I just wonder if there were any data.
I'm going into a case right now where which started yesterday, where the defendant is Latino, and I'm almost positive that the jury's going to be 100% white. Mm-hmm. So, things I'm going to pass around, one is a death row of inmates by state. So you can look up your state and see how many people you have on death row if you're in one of those 38 states. And then two of these pages with these colored pie charts on them have to do with race. And the fourth sheet is lost. So, you're not going to get, oh wait, maybe it's here. Nope, it isn't. So here's three sheets that are just sort of, you can just sort of look at them, very general information. Anyhow, I think the race question is really bad. I think it's really bad for us. I think all of this is corrosive on the body politic. For us to live in a system and have the system represent us, to be part of a system that thinks that might makes right, because we can execute people, we do, and to say that it's okay that there are all these injustices. I think in this case, the inequity, the unfairness, begins to equal iniquity, which is sin. So another one is poverty. And poverty is an absolute predictor for getting on death row. If you looked at everybody on death row in the whole country, you'd probably find, I know actually of 2 or 3 people, high profile people, who were not poor. but practically everybody is poor. And not everybody in the country is poor. So I'm going to read you some more Stephen Bright on the poverty question. The Constitution, as interpreted, so this is a quote from a judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. He put it bluntly in one capital case. The Constitution, as interpreted by the courts, does not require that the accused, even in capital cases, be represented by able or effective counsel. So, you know, if you've got money, of course, you're going to hire yourself some able or effective counsel. But the Constitution doesn't require that. Consequently, accused persons who are represented by not legally ineffective, because ineffective assistance at trial is a legal category of things that a lawyer can do wrong so that the case can be retried, sent back down for retrial. Accused persons who are represented by not legally ineffective lawyers may be condemned to die when the same accused, if represented by effective counsel, would receive at least the clemency of a life sentence. So, what that means in practice is that if you're poor, you will be assigned counsel in many states. I'm happy to say Illinois is not one of them. In Illinois, you get a public defender, and if you're a public defender trying capital cases, you are well trained. You're not necessarily motivated, you're not necessarily effective, but you're well trained. But in many, many, many states, there's a list of attorneys who are willing and able to try these cases that judges turn to, and they, of course, give them to their pals and to people that, you know, they may be money changing hands or for whatever reason, and or they don't like the defendant and they give them who they know to be a terrible lawyer. So then you get stories like this. Seated beside his client, a convicted capital murderer, defense attorney John Benn spent much of Thursday afternoon's trial in apparent deep sleep. His mouth kept falling open and his head lolled back on his shoulders. Then he wakened just long enough to catch himself and sit upright. Then it happened again and again and again. Every time he opened his eyes, a different prosecution witness was on the stand, describing another aspect of the killing. When State District Judge Doug Shaver finally called a recess, Ben was asked if he truly had fallen asleep during a capital murder trial. "It's boring," the 72-year-old longtime Houston lawyer explained. Court observers said Ben seemed to have slept his way through virtually the entire trial. This sleeping did not offend the Sixth Amendment, the trial judge explained, because if the Constitution doesn't say the lawyer has to be awake. On appeal, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals rejected McFarland's claim that he was denied his right to counsel over the dissent of two judges who pointed out that a sleeping counsel is unprepared to present evidence, to cross-examine witnesses, and to present any coordinated effort to evaluate evidence or present a defense. So it was appealed, and it was still lost, even though two of the judges pointed out that an unconscious judge was not going to be much use to you. McFarland is only one of three people sentenced to death in Houston at a trial where his lawyer slept. So they go on and tell some stories about those others. And they're all denied relief on habeas corpus on appeal. The Texas Attorney General's Office argued to the appellate court that a sleeping lawyer is no different from a lawyer who is intoxicated under the influence of drugs, suffering from Alzheimer's disease or mental illness. While this would seem to be an argument for upholding the district court's decision, it was not. Death sentences have been upheld in cases in which the lawyers were drunk, drug impaired, suffering from Alzheimer's, and severe mental illness. The judges even engaged counsel for Texas on the point, asking if there was not some difference between a lawyer who was under the influence of alcohol and one who was completely unconscious. The lawyer for Texas argued that while Burdine had received shoddy representation, it was not so bad that he was entitled to a new trial. And then it was overturned finally. The panel of the Fifth Circuit reversed the grant of habeas, creating a cruel catch-22. The two judges denied relief again because the trial record did not show during which portions of the trial Cannon was sleeping. Of course, the person himself responsible for making the record was Cannon himself, who was asleep.
Where was that?
Houston, Texas.
I remember it.
It's really hard not to feel hopeless about the system. Mm-hmm. I've lived in Texas, and it's really hard to not feel really hopeless about our criminal justice system. That's what I struggle with all the time.
Mm-hmm. I won't take a Texas case. I can't afford the emotional hopelessness. I have no answer for you. I agree with you.
Yeah,
I think it's just an abomination.
It's horrible.
I've been asked to take Texas cases, and I won't. You know, and I'm pretty good at my work.
Yeah.
So that means if other people are like me, who are good at their work, and say no, then you know who they're going to get.
Right.
Okay. Well, off the subject here, but I guess I don't understand these statistics. Like death row inmates, California has 652, and Illinois has 9. Does that mean Illinois kills them faster, or?
No, that's a wonderful question, though. Illinois had a wonderful lawyer, a wonderful governor, George Ryan, who around in 2001 and 2, when he was governor, had to sign a death warrant for someone who was going to be executed. One day, you have to sign it the day before their execution at midnight. And he signed it, and then he couldn't sleep all night. And it made him so nervous that he ordered his staff to start investigating the 170 people who were on death row at that time. And they investigated each case of those 170 cases, and they made reports to the governor, and the governor began to see that there were problems. He's a pharmacist from Kankakee, Illinois, and he's a Republican, and he ran on a pro-death penalty platform. And he
reversed himself.
Gradually got increasingly, he finally met some of the people who were on death row. He met with the families, he met with the murder victims' families. He studied it more and more. Finally, first he suspended executions. He said, we're not going to execute anybody else till we fix this system. And so he didn't have to sign any more death warrants. But then a couple days before his end of term, he was by then indicted for license for bribes, accepting bribes, money. I mean, he's an old-time Paul, and you know, he's our regular kind of politician in Illinois. We're comfortable with him.
Yeah.
But he commuted the sentences of everybody on death row, and which was 170 people, and he exonerated 4 of them and released them, one of which was one of mine.
Wow.
So we went down to 0, except about 5 people who were caught in a position where they had been granted already the relief of a new sentencing hearing. And they were awaiting their new sentencing hearing, which they thought was a stroke of good luck. It meant that they might not get the death penalty after all. And those 5 people, of course, we refused to give to commute the sentences. And we're gonna try to put them back in. So now we've been giving the death penalty to as many people as we can because the prosecution is also mad, but we're only up to 9. So
it's gonna increase.
It's going to increase. And then, and of course, the line waiting to be executed is shorter now, so it won't take so long to
keep it down.
So during the critical post-conviction review of capital cases, those condemned to die are not even entitled to a sleeping lawyer. Xavius Gibson, whose IQ was found on different tests to be between 76 and 82, could have been 75, he could have gotten out. Stood, not out, but I mean off the death penalty, stood totally bewildered in front of a judge at his first state post-conviction hearing in Georgia without a lawyer. The case proceeded as follows. Okay, Mr. Gibson, says the court, are you ready to proceed? Mr. Gibson, I don't have an attorney. The court, I understand that. Mr. Gibson, I'm not waiving my rights. The court, I understand that. Do you have any evidence to put up? Mr. Gibson, I don't know what to plead. The court, huh? Mr. Gibson, I don't know what to plead. The state of Georgia, which sought to bring about Gibson's execution, was represented by a lawyer who specializes in capital habeas corpus cases. So this very competent specialist put on his case. After the state's lawyer presented his testimony, the judge turned again to Mr. Gibson. Mr. Gibson, would you like to ask Mr. Mullis any questions? Mr. Gibson, I don't have any counsel. The court, I understand that, but I am asking, can you tell me yes or no, whether or not you want to ask him any questions? I am not my own counsel. I'm sorry, sir, I didn't understand you. I am not my own counsel. I understand that, but do you want to ask him anything? I don't know. Okay, thank you, Mr. Mullis, you can go down. This was a hearing which determined whether Xavius Gibson would be put to death. So, lots of those stories in here end badly, but that is the effect of poverty. That when you are poor, you just do not have access to all the things you need to defend yourself against the state. And the state is big. So that is something that we should also be unfortunately depressed about. There is another one of those cases that I'll just tell you about. I mean, this is bad stuff, you know. I think it's bad enough that my clients have good attorneys and they have me, but it gets much worse. I turned down a military case for a military tribunal, a death penalty case, a couple months ago because the guy was accused of shooting an officer in Iraq because he was from New York and he was a one of those people that just go out on the weekends and shoot guns.
Oh, reservist.
The reservist. And his unit got sent to Iraq and they were ordered to go on some kind of a death march. And this guy just said, I ain't going there. But I thought, a military tribunal, where the only experts I could have gotten to testify and to do psychoanalysis and all that stuff would have been military experts, military employees. The guy was toast, you know, and I didn't have the fortitude for it. Mm-hmm. I'm a weak person. So I'm sorry about that. There's this guy, Varnell Weeks. Every expert who evaluated Varnell Weeks, who was sentenced to death in Alabama, concluded that he was a paranoid schizophrenic who had suffered delusions and hallucinations. Weeks believed he was God in various manifestations, such as God the Father, Jesus Christ, the Allah. In court proceedings shortly before he was executed, Weeks appeared with a domino tied by a string to his head. In response to the judge's questions, he gave a rambling discourse on serpents, cybernetics, albinos, Egyptians, the Bible, and reproduction. He believed his execution was part of a millennial religious scheme to destroy a sinful mankind, and that he would not die but would be transformed into a tortoise to reign in heaven. And then the prison records revealed all this really crazy behavior in prison that you don't want to hear about, but it's pretty crazy. But we didn't spare him. We executed him. We execute the mentally ill all the time. Yeah. Mentally ill, I mean, I would say 9/10 of my clients are mentally ill. We believe in executing the mentally ill. She's a doctor.
So I'm a little naive here, but I thought there were laws against that. Yeah. I mean, don't they have people that are examining them? Because isn't it a law you can't?
No, it isn't a law. It's a law that you cannot execute the mentally retarded, and that's a recent law. And they still, even people who have been convicted and given the death penalty and are on death row now, are having a hell of a time getting a review to see if they're mentally retarded. Even people that are well established as being mentally retarded. And the mentally retarded people have to have a record of having been found to be retarded before they're 18. So if you suffered a major, massive head injury, for example, and your retardation stems from that, you don't count. So then you can still be executed. But we believe in executing the mentally ill, and we routinely do it.
Until 3 years ago, we executed children as young as 14. So it's, we're barbaric. Uh-huh.
Yeah, Texas does a lot of that. There's been a big discussion about executing the mentally ill and so forth. And so it's, I think the laws have been ahead with it anyway.
Isn't there a Supreme Court case, maybe I'm wrong, isn't there a Supreme Court case pending maybe next year about this issue? It's a young man who was schizophrenic and killed a policeman. I'm not sure.
I don't think so. My organ, I belong to the organization of people who do this work, and I'm on the board, and we're getting up a study project to try to start gathering statistics on the execution of the mentally ill so that we can bring a case, a test case, all the way through. But we want to gather the numbers and get everybody on board with us, people who do it. Another thing that is a problem is poverty. So we're going to leave poverty behind, but you get the point.
You skipped place.
Place, oh, I meant to say, I did place a couple days ago, and I don't want to do it again too soon after I did it. But let me just tell you that where you are indicted,
right,
where you commit your crime makes an enormous difference. So not even state to state. I mean, obviously the 12 states that don't have a death penalty. But in Houston, as we've been saying, I've got the number of some percentage here that's useful on this. In Houston executes more people every year than all the rest of the country combined except Texas. And a quarter, it executes a quarter the number of Dallas. But more people are murdered in Dallas. So Dallas has more murders, but a quarter the number of executions that Houston has. So it depends on the personnel. It depends on, one of the things about Houston is that there is actually a defender there, one of these bad, cheap defenders called Mock, who has lost every one of his cases defending an indigent person. And now they have something that in our field we call the mock wing on their death row because it is so full of his clients. He never presents any mitigation. He's, you know, but the prosecutors in Houston are determined. The prosecutors can decide, do they want to ask for death in any given case? So the next thing I want to say is that it's a political thing because so many prosecutors, if you read in your newspaper, who's named in any story about capital punishment? And who will be named in the paper are the prosecutors and the victim and the defendant, but never the defendant, the defender lawyers, the lawyers on the defense side. Almost never. So the prosecutors use it, it's well acknowledged that they use it as a stepping stone to a political office. So they're in, you know, they can be in the news every day as long as the trial's being tried, and they can be tough on crime, and they can, you know, be wanting to save us all from sin and death and the power of the devil. So, you know, if you want to become a governor, become a prosecutor first is one of the standard stepping stones. So it's a political issue. How often are you going to ask for the death penalty? Is this going to be a high-profile case? Is it going to look good in the media? Which it should not be a political football. Excuse me, I might be idealistic, but it's not a deterrent. Everybody says, well, we need the death penalty because it's a deterrent for crime. Studies show that it is not a deterrent. It doesn't deter any more than normal punishment. Almost everyone who commits murders commits them impulsively or commits them. The thought of the death penalty is not anywhere near the surface of their mind.
So if I were just a cold calculating governor and wanted to look just at the economics of it, what's the cheapest thing to do?
Excellent question.
Cheaper to put somebody in death row because they got.
And now I'm coming to my dollar sign.
Oh, I didn't see your dollar sign.
Aren't you smart? Thank you. The numbers are that it is in any given state between 3 and 6 times more expensive to ask for death in any case than it would be to just lock them up and throw away the key. There was a study recently in Georgia where they found that every death case, and this is including all the time that we, you know, a life in prison for someone who's 18 and is going to be in prison for the balance of his life. It's, in Georgia recently, they figured out that it, North Carolina figured out that it was 2.16 million dollars more per case to ask for death than try them on a capital case and go through all the appeals until the point of execution than it would be if they had just tried him as a flat-out murderer, given him life in prison, and thrown away the key. And so in any given state, as soon as a state decides to ask for the death penalty on any case, they've thrown $1 million of your dollars away immediately. And then if it proceeds, it doesn't plead out. Most cases end up pleading out. 95% of the cases in Cook County plead out. They take a plea before they go to trial. Once you've pled, you can't appeal. So that means you get natural life in prison, and you don't get tried at the risk of going to the death penalty. But the ones that go on to the death penalty then are legally entitled to 9 levels of appeal. And during those appeals, they can have lawyers, the state has lawyers, we have courtrooms, we have judges, we have people like me, we have all sorts of people, and it costs millions and millions of dollars.
Is anybody going to follow the case of this Jadli Muhammad Gay? He's already been given death in Maryland, right? I think it's 2. Now they want to try him. I think he is being tried. I don't know if the case is going on now. I can't imagine what they must have paid to try to get the death penalty in Maryland, and now they're going to run through the same thing in Virginia.
I don't know how I missed writing politics on here. I did it too fast. I wrote it on the board in the other room when I was over there preparing for the session.
I thought it was going to include politics. No, indicate that it's cheaper to execute somebody on death row than for life in prison. That the governor would want more people executed than to
You'd think, but it's just not true. So, Carol, I'm afraid that the reason they're going to try Jadli Muhammad again is because in a different state somebody wants to.
Right. Well, it's also because they kill people both in Maryland and in Virginia, and wherever, I'm not sure where he's been convicted the first time, but now people want their vengeance in the other state as well. But of course,
he's already got the death penalty.
Right, he's already got the death
penalty. Does Virginia have the death
penalty? What's the amount of time between their conviction and then they go on to kill the Lord? I mean, what's the average?
In Illinois, before George Ryan commuted all those sentences, the average was 11 and a half years. And I think that's pretty typical. But in the southern death penalty states, it's much faster. Texas is something like 3 years. So it depends somewhat on, you know, and the less time they give you, the less chance you have of saving the life of the person. So it's not a deterrent, and that is acknowledged everywhere. Even pro-death penalty activists are giving up the deterrence argument because the studies just don't uphold that. But it's a vengeance argument, as someone just said here. Who said vengeance?
Yeah.
So it depends on the state. But, you know, in a federal case, I think it's less than 11 and a half. Federal cases are more like 7 years. About 7 years. So.
But to go for an appeal will depend on the defense, right? I mean, that's not automatic. Appeals aren't automatic.
You're right. They're not automatic. So and the most often, if you don't appeal, it's not because your lawyer won't appeal, mm-hmm. at least in the states where they take this seriously. Mm-hmm. It's because the client becomes what we call in the business a volunteer. So the client says, I don't want to go on fighting this, I want to be executed. And we talked some about yesterday the role of our faith in all of this. I do think that if they had a presence with that was both aware of justice and aware of grace and forgiveness and redemption, somebody like me who was a Christian or somebody who was a Muslim who had faith in, I mean, I don't think it would necessarily have to come to the place where we have so many volunteers in the system, but the fact is that we do. So that's usually the reason that people don't appeal. It's routine to appeal as soon as you get a death penalty. It just, it's like the next note in a song. Unless your lawyer is so incompetent.
Well,
which is, you know, as I just pointed out.
Unless
your lawyer's asleep or drunk or schizophrenic.
That's awesome.
So it's really expensive. Justice Blackmun of the Supreme Court has a nice quote, which I always like to give you. Justice Blackmun, reviewing his efforts to assure the fairness of the death penalty during his career as a circuit and Supreme Court judge, found the death penalty experiment has failed and announced that he no longer would tinker with the machinery of death. And I don't want people killed when it's an experiment and when it's a machine and we're tinkering around with the machinery of death. And so for that reason, I would say that I feel that there's some calling that we as Christians have to be aware of this. The Lutheran Church and many other denominational bodies have social statements against the death penalty. I would recommend that you get them and use them in your adult classes in your churches. Read them, study them, talk about them, become aware about them, and then become aware of the criminal justice system. You know, the first time you get involved in the criminal justice system, it's just so horrifying and it's so shocking. You know, if your sister is arrested for something or you're somebody you know or one of your kids or, but watch what goes on in the news, be alert. Pay attention to when these policies are being changed. For example, in Illinois right now, we're trying to fix our death penalty so we can start executing people again. One of the ways that we're talking about fixing it is to videotape all of every interrogation, because there's so many false confessions. People confess all the time to murders that they don't do, and they're fed the facts by the arresting officers so that they know what to say. You know, and this is so documented and proved over and over again. So if the entire interrogation, not just the statement at the end, had to be videoed, and of course the objection by the police was, oh, it would take too much videotape. We can't do that. You know, sometimes we interrogate people for 3 days. Well, excuse me, maybe we should let them sleep. There's a concept. So, you know, then the people would see that we keep someone awake for 3 days until they confess. Mm-hmm. Don't let them pee, don't let them eat, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, but if we had to video that, then that would be getting at a very nasty sore in the body politic. Mm-hmm. Another thing is the way lineups are done. We have this idea that lineups should be like an old B movies, you know, where you trot out, shuffle out, you know, what, five guys, and they all stand and look solemn. A better, you know, that people do research on this stuff, and they figure out that false identifications are rampant. I mean, at Holden Village, I can hardly tell any one of you from anyone else of you. I'm just hopeless at stuff like that. I had a guy trying to break into my back door. I looked right at him and was calling the police, looking at him. And I looked away, and I couldn't think what he looked like. So now we want to have one at a time the people come in, and the person has to say yes or no, which I think is a much better way to do it. So there are a lot of ways in which incrementally we can improve the situation. I would also say to learn and study. And by that I mean look up the prison in your hometown or near your hometown. Sorry over my throat. Look it up online. Find out who's in there, how many are in there. What are they allowed to receive? There's always a list there of what they're allowed to receive. You can send stuff. You can learn a lot about the criminal justice system in your state just by looking. But it's also public knowledge. There are reports published every year. It'll tell you a prison is built to accommodate 600 people, and it's got 1,400 people in it. You know, think about that. Three people in a cell which is 5 by 9. So learn about your system. and ask questions. Do work. If you don't want to do work about the criminal justice system, political work, do work on something else, but do something to work for justice in your life, somewhere. You'll like your life, as all of you who do that know, better, and I think you'll be doing what Jesus wants. You can find someone to visit. You can call the local warden and say, I'm a Christian, and Jesus tells me that I should visit people in prison. How do I do that? And the warden will go, what? But you say, I really want to visit people in prison. How do I do that? How can I? And maybe you can work out something in your congregation or something. You can ask the warden, who are 30 people that are going to be there for 10 years or longer that no one comes to visit? Could I go visit one of those people? Could we have a list of those people? Could we adopt one of them, or five of them, or 10 of them? Could we go visit them in serially, all 30 of them? You know, you can do that. You're a citizen. You're allowed. The warden has to answer your questions. So you can, if you want to visit people in prison, you can do it. You can call and ask, who's on death row? Can I visit people on death row? Why not? You know, if you ask a few questions, they're automatic no, which comes out of their mouth. It's like that ad.
Oh, yeah, no. Never. Capital one.
Yeah. Wardens will automatically say no, but then you ask two or three questions and that breaks down right away. I find them to be actually sort of sweet. So you can do that. And then, of course, you should pray, I think. I think we should pray for victims of crimes, for the families of victims of crimes, for those on death row. We should pray for those who are in prison, because nobody is beyond the reach of our God. No one is. Thank you.